This is ArtBeat, WMUK's weekly look at creativity and the arts in Southwest Michigan. I'm Zinta A-Stars. First, our eyes are drawn to the gorgeous cover and illustrations by Glenn Wolfe. Soon, we want to look below the surface and begin to turn the pages. In her new book, The Accidental Reef and Other Ecological Odysseys in the Great Lakes, author Lynn Heasley beckons us to look below the surface of the Great Lakes. We take a deep dive with a close eye on lake sturgeon, zebra mussels, and other invasive species. We witness the destruction born of toxic pollutants and oil pipelines. With a mix of science and art, we are introduced to new ways of understanding the Great Lakes. Lynn, we begin with a marvelous pile of rocks. So let's start talking about the reef that you write about in your new book, Accidental Reef. What is a reef? How is it formed? And what makes it accidental?
Oh, so a reef is a generic term beyond what you would hear about in the tropics. It's a generic term for an assemblage, I guess I would say, of rocks that can be used as spawning beds for different kinds of aquatic life. And so the reef that I'm talking about is a pile of nondescript rocks in the bottom of the St. Clair River that no one knew about but became this really important spawning site for lake sturgeon especially, but also for walleye, round goby, red horse suckers, a whole universe of life that most of us wouldn't think about when we hear the term reef.
You also write about a kind of symbiotic partnership between science and art, science and the spiritual. Maybe you're going to explain what you mean by that and why you think we've lost it and how we might regain it.
Yes, that's a great question. I don't have a specific answer to that question, but it's something that I explore in the book, the history of science itself, including the history of taxonomy, history of biological sciences, fisheries sciences, ecology, has origins in which the arts are incredibly important to the development of the science, but also ways of knowing the natural world. And so if you look at the emergence of the Enlightenment and new ways of studying the natural world, going back to Linnaeus and other kind of proto-scientists, all the way to our modern disciplines today, the arts are very intrinsic to that. The visualization, the documentation of these incredible life forms and all of their infinite and marvelous detail. And along the way, and it's not just science itself, but it can be academia more generally, we've hardened into silos in which that symbiosis may still be there, but it's not as acknowledged and valued, and it's not something that the public sees. And so some of what I'm writing about in that chapter, that history of taxonomy and the walleye, is that we need to make those visible again. When a poet goes out in a field with ecologists, and I know many examples of that, what kind of knowledge, what kind of transformation of knowledge and new ways of understanding nature together symbiotically is there? And then can we bring our students and can we bring the public into that more open synergy between visual artists, between poets and writers, and then the working scientists in the field?
Is that what you mean when you've talked about the failure of Western science alone to protect the Great Lakes, our climate, our biodiversity?
Yes. So it's not to say that Western science has failed. It's to say that Western science as the primary leader in ways of conserving and protecting the places, the landscapes, the waters that we care about, that it needs partners, and those partners have to have more equality. And those partners may be the artists and writers. Those partners will certainly be indigenous communities, the First Nations and sovereign tribes in our area. Those partners will be local people who have this incredible, intense lay knowledge. And so in that sense, by putting all of that responsibility on a fisheries ecologist to solve the problem of Great Lakes aquatic food webs is not sustainable. They need the support and the partnership in all of these other ways and vice versa.
This is ArtBeat on WMUK. I'm Zinta A-Stars. I think we should also touch on Great Lakes resource extraction that's been happening over the last couple hundred years. Talk about that a little bit. I'm not always sure that Michigan residents realize what's happening to our lakes.
I think that might be one of the most surprising parts of the book for people. That's part three. And so just to back up a little bit, I've divided the accidental reef into three parts. And part one is really a hyper-local underwater perspective, very ecocentric, very much focusing on the aquatic life. And that's how we learn, right? We learn small places, and then we move up over time and layer our knowledge. Part two of the book with Greg and Kathy, but also these human scale issues of environmental problems and problem solving and change over time, that gets us to a scale that many of us are more comfortable with when we're reading about and learning about the Great Lakes, and we can put our own experiences into that. But part three of the book goes up to those satellite scales that are much harder to get your arms around when you're trying to learn about a place as vast as the Great Lakes and one that's managed by two countries, you know, by the U.S. and Canada. So the Great Lakes is also a border water. And the scale of the Great Lakes is just, it's a hard thing to learn over time. And so in terms of resource extraction, I make an argument in the book about the paradox of abundance. Paradox of abundance is what I establish as a condition in which there's such a great concentration of natural resources in a place that that very abundance and concentration is the seed of its ultimate destruction for extraction at a pace or at an intensity before communities can slow it down and look for more sustainable paths forward. So the Great Lakes region is a heart of abundant resources beyond what I would imagine that most of us could conceive of. So you can think of the white pine of the 19th century and the liquidation of that white pine in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota in just a matter of decade. And yet, if you study the history of that, people would say, oh, it's limitless. There's so much. We have amazing deposits of salt and brine, which many people don't know about. We have the largest extent of coastal sand dunes in the Great Lakes in the whole world, and that sand itself is incredibly valuable right now and always under risk of extraction. And of course, we have the fish, the abundance of lake sturgeon, who are almost driven to extinction, the actual extinction of Arctic grayling. So you can go across a whole set of resources in the Great Lakes whose abundance was once called limitless. And yet the extraction is on a scale or pace that's hard to get your arms around. And so in the third part of the book, The Paradox of Abundance, I made a series of efforts to try to understand, you know, the scale of the Great Lakes, the scale of water law involving the Great Lakes, but also the scale of extraction in the Great Lakes. And so I think for many readers, it will confirm some of their instincts, but they might not have seen it as a whole before.
I'm Zinta A-Stars. You've been listening to WMUK's Artbeat, our weekly look at the creative arts. I've been speaking with Lynn Heasley, the author of The Accidental Reef and Other Ecological Odysseys in the Great Lakes. Visit WMUK.org to hear more of our conversation. And join us every Friday at this time for Artbeat. Thanks for listening.